It was impossible not to like any group so openly enthusiastic about dinosaurs. Grant used to watch kids in museums as they stared open-mouthed at the big skeletons rising above them. He wondered what their fascination really represented. He finally decided that children liked dinosaurs because these giant creatures personified the uncontrollable force of looming authority. They were symbolic parents, fascinating and frightening like parents. And kids loved them, as they loved their parents. Grant also suspected that that was why even young children learned the names of dinosaurs. It never failed to amaze him when a 3-year-old shrieked, "Stegosaurus!" Saying these complicated names was a way of exerting power over the giants, a way of being in control. "What do you know about Velociraptor?" Grant asked Tim. He was just making conversation. "It's a small carnivore that hunted in packs, like Deinonychus," Tim said. "That's right," Grant said, "although Deinonychus is now considered one of the Velociraptors, and the evidence for pack hunting is all circumstantial. It derives in part from the appearance of the animals, which are quick and strong, but small for dinosaurs, just 150 to 300 pounds each. We assume they hunted in groups if they were to bring down larger prey. And there are some fossil finds in which a single large prey animal is associated with several raptor skeletons, suggesting they hunted in packs. And, of course, raptors were large-brained, more intelligent than most dinosaurs."
"How intelligent is that?" Malcolm asked.
"Depends on who you talk to," Grant said. "Just as paleontologists have come around to the idea that dinosaurs were probably warm-blooded, a lot of us are starting to think some of them might have been quite intelligent, too, but nobody knows for sure." They left the visitor area behind, and soon they heard the loud hum of generators, smelled the faint odor of gasoline. They passed a grove of palm trees and saw a large, low concrete shed with a steel roof. The noise seemed to come from there. They looked in the shed.
"It must be a generator," Ellie said.
"It's big," Grant said, peering inside. The power plant actually extended 2 stories below ground level, a vast complex of whining turbines and piping that ran down in the earth lit by harsh electric bulbs. "They can't need all this just for a resort," Malcolm said. "They're generating enough power here for a small city."
"Maybe for the computers?"
"Maybe." Grant heard bleating and walked north a few yards. He came to an animal enclosure with goats. By a quick count, he estimated there were 50 or 60 goats.
"What's that for?" Ellie asked.
"Beats me."
"Probably they feed them to the dinosaurs," Malcolm said.
The group walked on, following a dirt path through a dense bamboo grove. At the far side, they came to a double-layer chain-link fence 12 feet high, with spirals of barbed wire at the top. There was an electric hum along the outer fence. Beyond the fences, Grant saw dense clusters of large ferns, 5 feet high. He heard a snorting sound, a kind of snuffling. Then the sound of crunching footsteps coming closer. Then a long silence.
"I don't see anything," Tim whispered finally.
"Shh." Grant waited. Several seconds passed. Flies buzzed in the air. He still saw nothing. Ellie tapped him on the shoulder and pointed. Amid the ferns, Grant saw the head of an animal. It was motionless, partially hidden in the fronds, the 2 large dark eyes watching them coldly. The head was 2 feet long. From a pointed snout, a long row of teeth ran back to the hole of the auditory meatus, which served as an ear. The head reminded him of a large lizard, or perhaps a crocodile. The eyes did not blink, and the animal did not move. Its skin was leathery, with a pebbled texture, and basically the same coloration as the infant's, yellow-brown, with darker reddish markings like the stripes of a tiger. As Grant watched, a single forelimb reached up very slowly to part the ferns beside the animal's face. The limb, Grant saw, was strongly muscled. The hand had 3 grasping fingers, each ending in curved claws. The hand gently, slowly, pushed aside the ferns. Grant felt a chill and thought, "He's hunting us." For a mammal like man, there was something indescribably alien about the way reptiles hunted their prey. No wonder men hated reptiles. The stillness, the coldness, the pace was all wrong. To be among alligators or other large reptiles was to be reminded of a different kind of life, a different kind of world, now vanished from the earth. Of course, this animal didn't realize that he had been spotted, that he... The attack came suddenly, from the left and right. Charging raptors covered the 10 yards to the fence with shocking speed. Grant had a blurred impression of powerful 6-foot-tall bodies, stiff balancing tails, limbs with curving claws, open jaws with rows of jagged teeth. The animals snarled as they came forward, and then leapt bodily into the air, raising their hind legs with their big dagger claws. Then they struck the fence in front of them, throwing off twin bursts of hot sparks. The velociraptors fell backward to the ground, hissing. The visitors all moved forward, fascinated. Only then did the third animal attack, leaping up to strike the fence at chest level. Tim screamed in fright as the sparks exploded all around him. The creature snarled, a low reptilian hissing sound, and leapt back among the ferns. Then they were gone, leaving behind a faint odor of decay and hanging acrid smoke.
"Holy shit," Tim said. "It was so fast," Ellie said.
"Pack hunters," Grant said, shaking his head. "Pack hunters for whom ambush is an instinct."
"Fascinating."
"I wouldn't call them tremendously intelligent," Malcolm said. On the other side of the fence they heard snorting in the palm trees. Several heads poked slowly out of the foliage. Grant counted 3, 4, 5. The animals watched them, staring coldly. A black man in coveralls came running up to them. "Are you all right?" "We're okay," Grant said. "The alarms were set off." The man looked at the fence, dented and charred.
"They attacked you?"
"3 of them did, yes." The black man nodded.
"They do that all the time. Hit the fence, take a shock. They never seem to mind."
"Not too smart, are they?" Malcolm said. The black man paused. He squinted at Malcolm in the afternoon light.
"Be glad for that fence, senor," he said, and turned away.
From beginning to end, the entire attack could not have taken more than 6 seconds. Grant was still trying to organize his impressions. The speed was astonishing. The animals were so fast he had hardly seen them move. Walking back, Malcolm said, "They are remarkably fast." "Yes," Grant said, "much faster than any living reptile. A bull alligator can move quickly, but only over a short distance, 5 or 6 feet. Big lizards like the 5-foot Komodo dragons of Indonesia have been clocked at 30 miles an hour, fast enough to run down a man, and they kill men all the time. But I'd guess the animal behind the fence was more than twice that fast."
"Cheetah speed," Malcolm said, 60-70 miles an hour.
"Exactly." "But they seem to dart forward," Malcolm said, "rather like birds."
"Yes.
In the contemporary world, only very small mammals like the cobra-fighting mongoose had such quick responses. Small mammals. And, of course, birds. The snake-hunting secretary bird of Africa, or the cassowary. In fact, the velociraptor conveyed precisely the same impression of deadly, swift menace Grant had seen in the cassowary, the clawed, ostrich-like bird of New Guinea. So, these velociraptors look like reptiles with the skin and general appearance of reptiles, but they move like birds, with the speed and predatory intelligence of birds. Is that about it?" Malcolm said.
"Yes," Grant said. "I'd say they display a mixture of traits."
"Does that surprise you?"
"Not really," Grant said. "It's actually rather close to what paleontologists believed a long time ago."
When the first giant bones were found in the 1820s and 1830s, scientists felt obliged to explain the bones as belonging to some oversized variant of a modern species. This was because it was believed that no species could ever become extinct, since God would not allow one of his creations to die. Eventually, it became clear that this conception of God was mistaken, and the bones belonged to extinct animals. But what kind of animals? In 1842, Richard Owen, the leading British anatomist of the day, called them dinosauria, meaning terrible lizards. Owen recognized that dinosaurs seemed to combine traits of lizards, crocodiles, and birds. In particular, dinosaur hips were bird-like, not lizard-like. And unlike lizards, many dinosaurs seemed to stand upright. Owen imagined dinosaurs to be quick-moving, active creatures, and his view was accepted for the next 40 years. But when truly gigantic finds were unearthed, animals that had weighed 100 tons in life, scientists began to envision the dinosaurs as stupid, slow-moving giants destined for extinction. The image of the sluggish reptile gradually predominated over the image of the quick-moving bird. In recent years, scientists like Grant had begun to swing back toward the idea of more active dinosaurs. Grant's colleagues saw him as radical in his conception of dinosaur behavior, but now he had to admit his own conception had fallen far short of the reality of these large, incredibly swift hunters. "Actually, what I was driving at," Malcolm said, "was this. Is it a persuasive animal to you? Is it, in fact, a dinosaur?"
"I'd say so, yes."
"And a coordinated attack behavior to be expected," Grant said. "According to the fossil record, packs of velociraptors were capable of bringing down animals that weighed 1,000 pounds, like Tenontosaurus, which could run as fast as a horse. Coordination would be required." "How do they do that without language?" "Oh, language isn't necessary for coordinated hunting," Ali said. "Chimpanzees do it all the time. A group of chimps will stalk a monkey and kill it. All communication is by eyes."
"And were the dinosaurs, in fact, attacking us?"
"Yes."
"They would kill us and eat us if they could?" Malcolm said.
"I think so." "The reason I ask," Malcolm said, "is that I'm told large predators such as lions and tigers are not born man-eaters. Isn't that true? These animals must learn somewhere along the way that human beings are easy to kill. Only afterward do they become man-killers."
"Yes, I believe that's true," Grant said.
"Well, these dinosaurs must be even more reluctant than lions and tigers. After all, they come from a time before human beings or even large mammals existed at all. God knows what they think when they see us. So I wonder, have they learned somewhere along the line that humans are easy to kill?"
The group fell silent as they walked.
"In any case," Malcolm said, "I shall be extremely interested to see the control room now."
Version 4.4.
"Was there any problem with the group?" Hammond asked.
"No," Henry Wu said, "there was no problem at all. They accepted your explanation."
"Why shouldn't they?" Wu said. "It's all quite straightforward, in the broad strokes. It's only the details that get sticky, and I wanted to talk about the details with you today. You can think of it as a matter of aesthetics."
John Hammond wrinkled his nose as if he smelled something disagreeable.
"Aesthetics?" he repeated.
They were standing in the living room of Hammond's elegant bungalow, set back among palm trees in the northern sector of the park. The living room was airy and comfortable, fitted with a half-dozen video monitors showing the animals in the park. The file Wu had brought, stamped Animal Development :Version 4.4, lay on the coffee table. Hammond was looking at him in that patient, paternal way. Wu, 33 years old, was acutely aware that he had worked for Hammond all his professional life. Hammond had hired him right out of graduate school.
"Of course, there are practical consequences as well," Wu said. "I really think you should consider my recommendations for Phase 2. We should go to version 4.4.
"You want to replace all the current stock of animals?" Hammond said.
"Yes, I do."
"Why? What's wrong with them?"
"Nothing," Wu said, "except that they're real dinosaurs."
"That's what I asked for, Henry," Hammond said, smiling. "And that's what you gave me."
"I know," Wu said, "but you see..." He paused. How could he explain this to Hammond?
Hammond hardly ever visited the island, and it was a peculiar situation that Wu was trying to convey.
"Right now, as we stand here, almost no one in the world has ever seen an actual dinosaur. Nobody knows what they're really like."
"Yes,
the dinosaurs we have now are real," Wu said, pointing to the screens around the room. "But in certain ways they are unsatisfactory, unconvincing. I could make them better."
"Better in what way?"
"For one thing, they move too fast," Henry Wu said. "People aren't accustomed to seeing large animals that are so quick. I'm afraid visitors will think the dinosaurs look speeded up, like film, running too fast."
"But, Henry, these are real dinosaurs. You said so yourself."
"I know," Wu said. "But we could easily breed slower, more domesticated dinosaurs."
"Domesticated dinosaurs," Hammond snorted.
Nobody wants domesticated dinosaurs, Henry. They want the real thing.
But that's my point, Wu said. I don't think they do. They want to see their expectation, which is quite different.
Hammond was frowning.
You said yourself, John, this park is entertainment, Wu said, and entertainment has nothing to do with reality. Entertainment is antithetical to reality.
Hammond sighed.
Now, Henry, are we going to have another one of those abstract discussions? You know I like to keep it simple. The dinosaurs we have now are real, and...
Well, not exactly, Wu said. He paced the living room, pointed to the monitors. I don't think we should kid ourselves. We haven't recreated the past here. The past is gone. It can never be recreated. What we've done is reconstruct the past, or at least a version of the past, and I'm saying we can make a better version.
Better than real?
Why not, Wu said. After all, these animals are already modified. We've inserted genes to make them patentable and to make them lysine-dependent. And we've done everything we can to promote growth and accelerate development into adulthood.
Hammond shrugged.
That was inevitable. We didn't want to wait. We have investors to consider.
Of course. But I'm just saying, why stop there? Why not push ahead to make exactly the kind of dinosaur that we'd like to see? One that is more acceptable to visitors and one that is easier for us to handle. A slower, more docile version for our park.
Hammond frowned.
But then the dinosaurs wouldn't be real.
But they're not real now, Wu said. That's what I'm trying to tell you. There isn't any reality here.
He shrugged helplessly. He could see he wasn't getting through. Hammond had never been interested in technical details, and the essence of the argument was technical. How could he explain to Hammond about the reality of DNA dropouts, the patches, the gaps in the sequence that Wu had been obliged to fill in, making the best guesses he could, but still making guesses? The DNA of the dinosaurs was like old photographs that had been retouched, basically the same as the original, but in some places repaired and clarified, and as a result...
Now, Henry, Hammond said, putting his arm around Wu's shoulder... If you don't mind my saying so, I think you're getting cold feet. You've been working very hard for a long time, and you've done a hell of a job. A hell of a job. And it's finally time to reveal to some people what you've done. It's natural to be a little nervous, to have some doubts. But I am convinced, Henry, that the world will be entirely satisfied. Entirely satisfied.
As he spoke, Hammond steered him toward the door.
But John, Wu said, remember back in 87, when we started to build the containment devices? We didn't have any full-grown adults yet, so we had to predict what we'd need. We ordered big taser shockers, cars with cattle prods mounted on them, guns that blow out electric nets, all built specially to our specifications. We've got a whole array of devices now, and they're all too slow. We've got to make some adjustments. You know that Muldoon wants military equipment, law missiles, and laser-guided devices?
Let's leave Muldoon out of this, Hammond said. I'm not worried. It's just a zoo, Henry.
The phone rang and Hammond went to answer it. Wu tried to think of another way to press his case, but the fact was that after 5 long years, Jurassic Park was nearing completion, and John Hammond just wasn't listening to him anymore. There had been a time when Hammond listened to Wu very attentively, especially when he had first recruited him, back in the days when Henry Wu was a 28-year-old graduate student getting his doctorate at Stanford in Norman Atherton's lab. Atherton's death had thrown the lab into confusion as well as mourning. No one knew what would happen to the funding or the doctoral programs. There was a lot of uncertainty. People worried about their careers. 2 weeks after the funeral, John Hammond came to see Wu. Everyone in the lab knew that Atherton had had some association with Hammond, although the details were never clear, but Hammond had approached Wu with a directness Wu never forgot.
Norman always said you're the best geneticist in his lab, he said. What are your plans now?
I don't know. Research.
You want a university appointment?
Yes.
That's a mistake, Hammond said briskly. At least if you respect your talent.
Wu had blinked.
Why?
Because let's face facts, Hammond said. Universities are no longer the intellectual centers of the country. The very idea is preposterous. Universities are the backwater. Don't look so surprised. I'm not saying anything you don't know. Since World War II, all the really important discoveries have come out of private laboratories. The laser, the transistor, the polio vaccine, the microchip, the hologram, the personal computer, magnetic resonance imaging, CAT scans, the list goes on and on. Universities simply aren't where it's happening anymore. And they haven't been for 40 years. If you want to do something important in computers or genetics, you don't go to a university, dear me, no.
Wu found he was speechless.
Good heavens, Hammond said. What must you go through to start a new project? How many grant applications? How many forms? How many approvals? The steering committee? The department chairman? The university resources committee? How do you get more workspace if you need it? More assistance if you need them? How long does all that take? A brilliant man can't squander precious time with forms and committees. Life is too short, and DNA too long. You want to make your mark. If you want to get something done, stay out of universities.
In those days, Wu desperately wanted to make his mark. John Hammond had his full attention.
I'm talking about work, Hammond continued. Real accomplishment. What does a scientist need to work? He needs time. And he needs money. I'm talking about giving you a 5-year commitment and $10 million a year in funding. $50 million. And no one tells you how to spend it. You decide. Everyone else just gets out of your way.
It sounded too good to be true. Wu was silent for a long time. Finally he said,
In return for what?
For taking a crack at the impossible, Hammond said. For trying something that probably can't be done.
What does it involve?
I can't give you details, but the general area involves cloning reptiles.
I don't think that's impossible, Wu said. Reptiles are easier than mammals. Cloning's probably only 10-15 years off, assuming some fundamental advances.
I've got 5 years, Hammond said, and a lot of money, for somebody who wants to take a crack at it now.
Is my work publishable?
Eventually.
Not immediately, no.
But eventually publishable?
Wu asked, sticking on this point.
Hammond had laughed. Don't worry. If you succeed, the whole world will know about what you've done, I promise you.
And now it seemed the whole world would indeed know, Wu thought. After 5 years of extraordinary effort, they were just a year away from opening the park to the public. Of course, those years hadn't gone exactly as Hammond had promised. Wu had had some people telling him what to do, and many times fearsome pressures were placed on him, and the work itself had shifted. It wasn't even reptilian cloning, once they began to understand that dinosaurs were so similar to birds. It was avian cloning, a very different proposition, much more difficult. And for the last 2 years, Wu had been primarily an administrator, supervising teams of researchers and banks of computer-operated gene sequencers. Administration wasn't the kind of work he relished. It wasn't what he had bargained for. Still, he had succeeded. He had done what nobody really believed could be done, at least in so short a time. And Henry Wu thought that he should have some rights, some say in what happened, by virtue of his expertise and his efforts. Instead, he found his influence waning with each passing day. The dinosaurs existed. The procedures for obtaining them were worked out to the point of being routine. The technologies were mature, and John Hammond didn't need Henry Wu anymore.
That should be fine, Hammond said, speaking into the phone.
He listened for a while and smiled at Wu.
Fine. Yes, fine.
He hung up.
Where were we, Henry?
We were talking about Phase 2, Wu said.
Oh, yes. We've gone over some of this before, Henry.
I know, but you don't realize...
Excuse me, Henry, Hammond said with an edge of impatience in his voice. I do realize. And I must tell you frankly, Henry, I see no reason to improve upon reality. Every change we've made in the genome has been forced on us by law or necessity. We may make other changes in the future to resist disease or for other reasons, but I don't think we should improve upon reality just because we think it's better that way. We have real dinosaurs out there now. That's what people want to see, and that's what they should see. That's our obligation, Henry. That's honest, Henry.
And smiling, Hammond opened the door for him to leave. Control. Grant looked at all the computer monitors in the darkened control room, feeling irritable. Grant didn't like computers. He knew that this made him old-fashioned, dated as a researcher, but he didn't care. Some of the kids who worked for him had a real feeling for computers, an intuition. Grant never felt that. He found computers to be alien, mystifying machines. Even the fundamental distinction between an operating system and an application left him confused and disheartened, literally lost in a foreign geography he didn't begin to comprehend. But he noticed that Gennaro was perfectly comfortable, and Malcolm seemed to be in his element, making little sniffing sounds like a bloodhound on a trail.
"You want to know about control mechanisms?" John Arnold said, turning in his chair in the control room.
The head engineer was a thin, tense, chain-smoking man of 45. He squinted at the others in the room.
"We have unbelievable control mechanisms," Arnold said, and lit another cigarette.
"For example," Gennaro said.
"For example, animal tracking."
Arnold pressed a button on his console, and the vertical glass map lit up with a pattern of jagged blue lines.
"That's our juvenile T-Rex, the little Rex. All his movements within the park over the last 24 hours.
Arnold pressed the button again.
"Previous 24.
And again,
previous 24.
The lines on the map became densely overlaid, a child's scribble. But the scribble was localized in a single area, near the southeast side of the lagoon.
"You get a sense of his home range over time," Arnold said. "He's young, so he stays close to the water, and he stays away from the big adult Rex. You put up the big Rex and the little Rex, and you'll see their paths never cross."
"Where is the big Rex right now?" Gennaro asked. Arnold pushed another button. The map cleared, and a single glowing spot with a code number appeared in the fields northwest of the lagoon.
"He's right there."
"And the little Rex?"
"Hell, I'll show you every animal in the park," Arnold said.
The map began to light up like a Christmas tree, dozens of spots of light, each tagged with a code number.
"That's 238 animals as of this minute."
"How accurate?"
"Within 5 feet."
Arnold puffed on the cigarette.
"Let's put it this way. You drive out in a vehicle, and you'll find the animals right there, exactly as they're shown on the map."
"How often is this updated?"
"Every 30 seconds.
"Pretty impressive," Gennaro said. "How's it done?"
"We have motion sensors all around the park," Arnold said. "Most of them hardwired, some radio telemetered. Of course, motion sensors won't usually tell you the species, but we get image recognition direct off the video. Even when we're not watching the video monitors, the computer is, and checking where everybody is."
"Does the computer ever make a mistake?"
"Only with the babies. It mixes those up sometimes because they're such small images, but we don't sweat that. The babies almost always stay close to herds of adults. Also, you have the category tally."
"What's that?"
"Once every 15 minutes, the computer tallies the animals in all categories," Arnold said. "Like this."
Total animals, 238. Tyrannosaurs expected, 2. Found, 2. Version 4.1. Myosaurs expected, 21. Found, 21. Version 3.3. Stegosaurs expected, 4. Found, 4. Version 3.9. Triceratops expected, 8. Found, 8. Version 3.1. Procompsognathids expected, 49. Found, 49. Version 3.9. Othniellia expected, 16. Found, 16. Version 3.1. Velociraptors expected, 8. Found, 8. Version 3.0. Apatosaurs expected, 17. Found, 17. Version 3.1. Hadrosaurs expected, 11. Found, 11. Version 3.1. Dilophosaurs expected, 7. Found, 7. Version 4.3. Pterosaurs expected, 6.
Found, 6. Version 4.3. Hypsilobodontids expected, 33. Found, 33. Version 2.9. Euplocephalids expected, 16. Found, 16. Version 4.0. Styracosaurs expected, 18. Found, 18. Version 3.9. Microceratops expected, 22. Found, 22. Version 4.1. Total expected, 238. Total found, 238.
What you see here, Arnold said, is an entirely separate counting procedure. It isn't based on the tracking data, it's a fresh look. The whole idea is that the computer can't make a mistake because it compares two different ways of gathering the data. If an animal were missing, we'd know it within 5 minutes.
I see, Malcolm said. And has that ever actually been tested?
Well, in a way, Arnold said. We've had a few animals die. An Othnelian got caught in the branches of a tree and strangled. One of the stegos died of that intestinal illness that keeps bothering them. One of the hypsilophodonts fell and broke his neck. And in each case, once the animal stopped moving, the numbers stopped tallying, and the computer signaled an alert.
Within 5 minutes?
Yes.
Grant said, what is the right-hand column?
Release version of the animals. The most recent are version 4.1 or 4.3. We're considering going to version 4.4.
Version numbers? You mean like software, new releases?
Well, yes, Arnold said. It is like software, in a way. As we discover the glitches in the DNA, Dr. Wu's labs have to make a new version.
The idea of living creatures being numbered like software, being subject to updates and revisions, troubled Grant. He could not exactly say why it was too new a thought, but he was instinctively uneasy about it. They were, after all, living creatures.
Arnold must have noticed his expression because he said, look, Dr. Grant, there's no point getting starry-eyed about these animals. It's important for everyone to remember that these animals are created. Created by man. Sometimes there are bugs. So as we discover the bugs, Dr. Wu's labs have to make a new version. And we need to keep track of what version we have out there.
Yes, yes, of course you do, Malcolm said impatiently. But going back to the matter of counting, I take it all the counts are based on motion sensors?
Yes.
And these sensors are everywhere in the park?
They cover 92% of the land area, Arnold said. There are only a few places we can't use them. For example, we can't use them on the Jungle River, because the movement of the water and the convection rising from the surface screws up the sensors. But we have them nearly everywhere else. And if the computer tracks an animal into an unsensed zone, it'll remember and look for the animal to come out again. And if it doesn't, it gives us an alarm.
Now then, Malcolm said, you show 49 procompsognathids. Suppose I suspect that some of them aren't really the correct species. How would you show me that I'm wrong?
Two ways, Arnold said. First of all, I can track individual movements against the other presumed compies. Compies are social animals. They move in a group. We have two compy groups in the park, so the individual should be within either Group A or Group B.
Yes, but the other way is direct visual, he said. He punched buttons, and one of the monitors began to flick rapidly through images of compies numbered from 1 to 49.
These pictures are current ID images from within the last 5 minutes.
So you can see all the animals if you want to?
Yes. I can visually review all the animals whenever I want.
How about physical containment, General said. Can they get out of their enclosures?
Absolutely not, Arnold said. These are expensive animals, Mr. Gennaro. We take very good care of them. We maintain multiple barriers. First, the moats.
He pressed a button and the board lit up with a network of orange bars.
These moats are never less than 12 feet deep and water-filled. For bigger animals, the moats may be 30 feet deep. Next, the electrified fences.
Lines of bright red glowed on the board.
We have 50 miles of 12-foot-high fencing, including 22 miles around the perimeter of the island. All the park fences carry 10,000 volts. The animals quickly learn not to go near them.
But if one did get out, Gennaro said.
Arnold snorted and stubbed out his cigarette. Just hypothetically, Gennaro said, supposing it happened. Muldoon cleared his throat. We'd go out and get the animal back, he said. We have lots of ways to do that. Taser shotguns, electrified nets, tranquilizers. All non-lethal because, as Mr. Arnold says, these are expensive animals. Gennaro nodded. And if one got off the island? It'd die in less than 24 hours, Arnold said. These are genetically engineered animals. They're unable to survive in the real world.
How about this control system itself, Gennaro said. Could anybody tamper with it?
Arnold was shaking his head. The system is hardened. The computer is independent in every way. Independent power and independent backup power. The system does not communicate with the outside, so it cannot be influenced remotely by modem. The computer system is secure. There was a pause. Arnold puffed his cigarette. Hell of a system, he said. Hell of a goddamn system. Then I guess, Malcolm said, your system works so well, you don't have any problems. We've got endless problems here, Arnold said, raising an eyebrow. But none of the things you worry about. I gather you're worried that the animals will escape, and will get to the mainland and raise hell. We haven't got any concern about that at all. We see these animals as fragile and delicate. They've been brought back after 65 million years to a world that's very different from the one they left, the one they were adapted to. We have a hell of a time caring for them. You have to realize, Arnold continued, that men have been keeping mammals and reptiles in zoos for hundreds of years. So we know a lot about how to take care of an elephant or a croc, but nobody's ever tried to take care of a dinosaur before. They are new animals, and we just don't know. Diseases in our animals are the biggest concern.
Diseases? Gennaro said, suddenly alarmed. Is there any way that a visitor could get sick?
Arnold snorted again. You ever catch a cold from a zoo alligator, Mr. Gennaro? Zoos don't worry about that, neither do we. What we do worry about is the animals dying from their own illnesses or infecting other animals. But we have programs to monitor that, too. You want to see the big Rex's health file? His vaccination record? His dental record? That's something. You ought to see the vet scrubbing those big fangs so he doesn't get tooth decay.
Not just now, Gennaro said. What about your mechanical systems?
You mean the rides? Arnold said.
Grant looked up sharply. Rides?
None of the rides are running yet, Arnold was saying. We have the Jungle River ride, where the boats follow tracks underwater, and we have the Aviary Lodge ride, but none of it's operational yet. The park will open with a basic dinosaur tour, the one that you're about to take in a few minutes. The other rides will come online 6-12 months after that.
Wait a minute, Grant said. You're going to have rides? Like an amusement park?
Arnold said, this is a zoological park. We have tours of different areas, and we call them rides, that's all.
Grant frowned. Again, he felt troubled. He didn't like the idea of dinosaurs being used for an amusement park.
Malcolm continued his questions.
You can run the whole park from this control room?
Yes, Arnold said. I can run it single-handed if I have to. We've got that much automation built in. The computer by itself can track the animals, feed them, and fill their water troughs for 48 hours without supervision.
This is the system Mr. Nedry designed? Malcolm asked. Dennis Nedry was sitting at a terminal in the far corner of the room, eating a candy bar and typing.
Yes, that's right, Nedry said, not looking up from the keyboard.
It's a hell of a system, Arnold said proudly.
That's right, Nedry said absently. Just one or two minor bugs to fix.
Now, Arnold said, I see the tour is starting, so unless you have other questions...
Actually, just one, Malcolm said. Just a research question. You showed us that you can track the procompsognathids, and you can visually display them individually. Can you do any studies of them as a group? Measure them or whatever? If I wanted to know height or weight or...
Arnold was punching buttons. Another screen came up, headed Height Distribution Procompsognathids, over a graph showing a smooth, symmetrical distribution curve with a single peak at 34 centimeters,
based on the height of the Procompsognathids in the park.
We can do all of that, and very quickly, Arnold said. The computer takes measurement data in the course of reading the video screen, so it's translatable at once. You see, here we have a normal Poisson distribution for the animal population. It shows that most of the animals cluster around an average central value, and a few are either larger or smaller than the average at the tails of the curve.
You'd expect that kind of graph, Malcolm said.
Yes, any healthy biological population shows this kind of distribution. Now then, Arnold said, lighting another cigarette, are there any other questions?
No, Malcolm said. I've learned what I need to know.
As they were walking out, Gennaro said, it looks like a pretty good system to me. I don't see how any animals could get off this island.
Don't you? Malcolm said. I thought it was completely obvious.
Wait a minute, Gennaro said. You think animals have gotten out?
I know they have.
Gennaro said, but how? You saw for yourself. They can count all the animals. They can look at all the animals. They know where all the animals are at all times. How can one possibly escape?
Malcolm smiled.
It's quite obvious, he said. It's just a matter of your assumptions.
Your assumptions? Gennaro repeated, frowning.
Yes, Malcolm said. Look here. The basic event that has occurred in Jurassic Park is that the scientists and technicians have tried to make a new, complete biological world. And the scientists in the control room expect to see a natural world. As in the graph they just showed us. Even though a moment's thought reveals that nice, normal distribution is terribly worrisome on this island.
It is?
Yes. Based on what Dr. Wu told us earlier, one should never see a population graph like that.
Why not? Gennaro said.
Because that is a graph for a normal biological population, which is precisely what Jurassic Park is not. Jurassic Park is not the real world. It is intended to be a controlled world that only imitates the natural world. In that sense, it's a true park, rather like a Japanese formal garden, nature manipulated to be more natural than the real thing, if you will.
I'm afraid you've lost me, Gennaro said, looking annoyed.
I'm sure the tour will make everything clear, Malcolm said.
The tour.
This way, everybody, this way, Ed Regis said. By his side, a woman was passing out pith helmets with Jurassic Park labeled on the headband and a little blue dinosaur logo. A line of Toyota Land Cruisers came out of an underground garage beneath the visitor center. Each car pulled up, driverless and silent. Two black men in safari uniforms were opening the doors for passengers.
2 to 4 passengers to a car, please. 2 to 4 passengers to a car, a recorded voice was saying. Children under 10 must be accompanied by an adult. 2 to 4 passengers to a car, please.
Tim watched as Grant, Sattler, and Malcolm got into the first Land Cruiser with a lawyer, Gennaro. Tim looked over at Lex, who was standing, pounding her fist into her glove. Tim pointed to the first car and said,
Can I go with them?
I'm afraid they have some things to discuss, Ed Regis said. Technical things.
I'm interested in technical things, Tim said. I'd rather go with them.
Well, you'll be able to hear what they're saying, Regis said. We'll have a radio open between the cars.
The second car came. Tim and Lex got in, and Ed Regis followed.
These are electric cars, Regis said, guided by a cable in the roadway.
Tim was glad he was sitting in the front seat because mounted in the dashboard were 2 computer screens and a box that looked to him like a CD-ROM. That was a laser disc player controlled by a computer. There was also a portable walkie-talkie and some kind of a radio transmitter. There were 2 antennas on the roof and some odd goggles in the map pocket. The black men shut the doors of the Land Cruiser. The car started off with an electric hum. Up ahead, the 3 scientists and Gennaro were talking and pointing, clearly excited. Ed Regis said, Let's hear what they're saying. An intercom clicked.
I don't know what the hell you think you're doing here, Gennaro said over the intercom. He sounded very angry.
I know quite well why I'm here, Malcolm said.
You're here to advise me, not play goddamn mind games.
I've got 5% of this company and a responsibility to make sure that Hammond has done his job responsibly. Now, you goddamn come here.
Ed Regis pressed the intercom button and said, in keeping with the non-polluting policies of Jurassic Park, these lightweight electric Land Cruisers have been specially built for us by Toyota in Osaka. Eventually, we hope to drive among the animals, just as they do in African game parks. But for now, sit back and enjoy the self-guided tour. He paused. And, by the way, we can hear you back here.
Oh, Christ, Gennaro said. I have to be able to speak freely. I didn't ask for these damn kids to come...
Ed Regis smiled blandly and pushed a button. We'll just begin the show, shall we? They heard a fanfare of trumpets, and the interior screens flashed, Welcome to Jurassic Park. A sonorous voice said, Welcome to Jurassic Park. You are now entering the lost world of the prehistoric past, a world of mighty creatures long gone from the face of the earth, which you are privileged to see for the first time.
That's Richard Kiley, Ed Regis said. We spared no expense.
The Land Cruiser passed through a grove of low, stumpy palm trees. Richard Kiley was saying, Notice, first of all, the remarkable plant life that surrounds you. Those trees to your left and right are called cycads, the prehistoric predecessors of palm trees. Cycads were a favorite food of the dinosaurs. You can also see Benetitalians and ginkgos. The world of the dinosaur included more modern plants, such as pine and fir trees, and swamp cypresses. You will see these as well. The Land Cruiser moved slowly among the foliage. Tim noticed the fences and retaining walls were screened by greenery to heighten the illusion of moving through real jungle. We imagine the world of the dinosaurs, said Richard Kiley's voice, as a world of huge vegetarians, eating their way through the giant swampy forests of the Jurassic and Cretaceous world 100 million years ago. But most dinosaurs were not as large as people think. The smallest dinosaurs were no bigger than a house cat, and the average dinosaur was about as big as a pony. We are first going to visit one of these average-sized animals, called Hypsilophodonts. If you look to your left, you may catch a glimpse of them now. They all looked to the left. The Land Cruiser stopped on a low rise where a break in the foliage provided a view to the east. They could see a sloping forested area which opened into a field of yellow grass that was about 3 feet high. There were no dinosaurs.
Where are they?
Lex said. Tim looked at the dashboard. The transmitter lights blinked and the CD-ROM whirred. Obviously, the disc was being accessed by some automatic system. He guessed that the same motion sensors that tracked the animals also controlled the screens in the Land Cruiser. The screens now showed pictures of Hypsilophodonts and printed out data about them. The voice said, Hypsilophodonts are the gazelles of the dinosaur world, small, quick animals that once roamed everywhere in the world, from England to Central Asia to North America. We think these dinosaurs were so successful because they had better jaws and teeth for chewing plants than their contemporaries did. In fact, the name Hypsilophodontid means high-ridged tooth, which refers to the characteristic self-sharpening teeth of these animals. You can see them in the plains directly ahead, and also perhaps in the branches of the trees.
In the trees? Lex said. Dinosaurs in the trees?
Tim was scanning with binoculars, too.
To the right, he said. Halfway up that big green trunk.
In the dappled shadows of the tree, a motionless dark green animal about the size of a baboon stood on a branch. It looked like a lizard standing on its hind legs. It balanced itself with a long, drooping tail.
That's an Othnelia, Tim said.
The small animals you see are called Othnelia, the voice said, in honor of the 19th-century dinosaur hunter Othniel Marsh of Yale. Tim spotted two more animals on the higher branches of the same tree. They were all about the same size. None of them were moving.
Pretty boring, Lex said. They're not doing anything.
The main herd of animals can be found in the grassy plain below you, said the voice. We can rouse them with a simple mating call. A loudspeaker by the fence gave a long nasal call, like the honking of geese. From the field of grass directly to their left, six lizard heads poked up, one after another. The effect was comical, and Tim laughed. The heads disappeared.
The loudspeaker gave the call again, and once again the heads poked up, in exactly the same way, one after another. The fixed repetition of the behavior was striking. Hypsilophodonts are not especially bright animals, the voice explained. They have roughly the intelligence of a domestic cow. The heads were dull green, with a mottling of dark browns and blacks that extended down the slender necks. Judging from the size of the heads, Tim guessed their bodies were 4 feet long, about as large as deer. Some of the hypsilophodonts were chewing, the jaws working. One reached up and scratched its head with a five-fingered hand. The gesture gave the creature a pensive, thoughtful quality. If you see them scratching, that is because they have skin problems. The veterinary scientists here at Jurassic Park think it may be a fungus or an allergy, but they're not sure yet. After all, these are the first dinosaurs in history ever to be studied alive. The electric motor of the car started, and there was a grinding of gears. At the unexpected sound, the herd of hypsilophodonts suddenly leapt into the air and bounded above the grass like kangaroos, showing their full bodies with massive hind limbs and long tails in the afternoon sunlight. In a few leaps, they were gone. Now that we've had a look at these fascinating herbivores, we will go on to some dinosaurs that are a little larger. Quite a bit larger, in fact. The land cruisers continued onward, moving south through Jurassic Park. Control. Gears are grinding, John Arnold said in the darkened control room. Have maintenance check the electric clutches on vehicles BB-4 and BB-5 when they come back. Yes, Mr. Arnold, replied the voice on the intercom. A minor detail, Hammond said, walking in the room. Looking out, he could see the two land cruisers moving south through the park. Muldoon stood in the corner, silently watching. Arnold pushed his chair back from the central console at the control panel. There are no minor details, Mr. Hammond, he said, and he lit another cigarette. Nervous at most times, Arnold was especially edgy now. He was only too aware that this was the first time visitors had actually toured the park. In fact, Arnold's team didn't often go into the park. Harding, the vet, sometimes did. The animal handlers went to the individual feeding houses, but otherwise they watched the park from the control room. And now, with visitors out there, he worried about 100 details. John Arnold was a systems engineer who had worked on the Polaris submarine missile in the late 1960s, until he had his first child and the prospect of making weapons became too distasteful. Meanwhile, Disney had started to create amusement park rides of great technological sophistication, and they employed a lot of aerospace people. Arnold helped build Disney World in Orlando, and had gone on to implement major parks at Magic Mountain in California, Old Country in Virginia, and Astroworld in Houston. His continuous employment at parks had eventually given him a somewhat skewed view of reality. Arnold contended, only half-jokingly, that the entire world was increasingly described by the metaphor of the theme park. Paris is a theme park, he once announced after a vacation, although it's too expensive, and the park employees are unpleasant and sullen. For the past 2 years, Arnold's job had been to get Jurassic Park up and running. As an engineer, he was accustomed to long time schedules. He often referred to the September opening, by which he meant September of the following year. And as the September opening approached, he was unhappy with the progress that had been made. He knew from experience that it sometimes took years to work the bugs out of a single park ride, let alone get a whole park running properly. You're just a worrier, Hammond said. I don't think so, Arnold said. You've got to realize that from an engineering standpoint, Jurassic Park is by far the most ambitious theme park in history. Visitors will never think about it, but I do. He ticked the points off on his fingers. First, Jurassic Park has all the problems of any amusement park. Ride maintenance, queue control, transportation, food handling, living accommodations, trash disposal, security. Second, we have all the problems of a major zoo. Care of the animals, health and welfare, feeding and cleanliness, protection from insects, pests, allergies, and illnesses, maintenance of barriers, and all the rest. And finally, we have the unprecedented problems of caring for a population of animals that no one has ever tried to maintain before. Oh, it's not as bad as all that, Hammond said. Yes, it is.
You're just not here to see it, Arnold said. The tyrannosaurs drink the lagoon water and sometimes get sick. We aren't sure why. The triceratops females kill each other in fights for dominance and have to be separated into groups smaller than six. We don't know why. The stegosaurs frequently get blisters on their tongues and diarrhea for reasons no one yet understands, even though we've lost two. Hypsilophodonts get skin rashes. And the velociraptors...
Let's not start on the velociraptors, Hammond said. I'm sick of hearing about the velociraptors, how they're the most vicious creatures anyone has ever seen.
They are, Muldoon said in a low voice. They should all be destroyed.
You wanted to fit them with radio collars, Hammond said, and I agreed. Yes, and they promptly chewed the collars off.
But even if the raptors never get free, Arnold said, I think we have to accept that Jurassic Park is inherently hazardous.
Oh, balls, Hammond said. Whose side are you on, anyway?
We now have 15 species of extinct animals, and most of them are dangerous, Arnold said. We've been forced to delay the Jungle River ride because of the Dilophosaurs, and the Pteratops Lodge in the Avery, because the pterodactyls are so unpredictable. These aren't engineering delays, Mr. Hammond. They're problems with control of the animals.
You had plenty of engineering delays, Hammond said. Don't blame it on the animals.
Yes, we have.
In fact, it's all we could do to get the main attraction, Park Drive, working correctly, to get the CD-ROMs inside the cars to be controlled by the motion sensors. It's taken weeks of adjustment to get that working properly. And now the electric gear shifts on the cars are acting up. The gear shifts. Let's keep it in perspective, Hammond said. You get the engineering correct, and the animals will fall into place. After all, they're trainable.
From the beginning, this had been one of the core beliefs of the planners. The animals, however exotic, would fundamentally behave like animals in zoos anywhere. They would learn the regularities of their care, and they would respond.
Meanwhile, how's the computer? Hammond said.
He glanced at Dennis Nedry, who was working at a terminal in the corner of the room.
This damn computer has always been a headache. We're getting there, Nedry said. If you had done it right in the first place, Hammond began,
but Arnold put a restraining hand on his arm. Arnold knew there was no point in antagonizing Nedry while he was working.
It's a large system, Arnold said. There are bound to be glitches.
In fact, the bug list now ran to more than 130 items, and included many odd aspects. For example, the animal feeding program reset itself every 12 hours, not every 24 hours, and would not record feedings on Sundays. As a result, the staff could not accurately measure how much the animals were eating. The security system, which controlled all the security card-operated doors, cut out whenever main power was lost and did not come back on with auxiliary power. The security program only ran with main power. The physical conservation program, intended to dim lights after 10 p.m., only worked on alternate days of the week. The automated fecal analysis, called auto-poop, designed to check for parasites in the animal's stools, invariably recorded all specimens as having the parasite Phlogistomum venulosum, although none did. The program then automatically dispensed medication into the animal's food. If the handlers dumped the medicine out of the hoppers to prevent its being dispensed, an alarm sounded, which could not be turned off. And so it went, page after page of errors. When he had arrived, Dennis Nedry had been under the impression that he could make all the fixes himself over the weekend. He had paled when he saw the full listing. Now he was calling his office in Cambridge, telling his staff programmers they were going to have to cancel their weekend plans and work overtime until Monday. And he had told John Arnold that he would need to use every telephone link between Isla Nublar and the mainland just to transfer program data back and forth to his programmers. While Nedry worked, Arnold punched up a new window in his own monitor. It allowed him to see what Nedry was doing at the corner console. Not that he didn't trust Nedry, but Arnold just liked to know what was going on. He looked at the graphics display on his right-hand console, which showed the progress of the electric land cruisers. They were following the river, just north of the aviary and the Ornithischian paddock. "If you look to your left," said the voice, "you will see the dome of the Jurassic Park aviary, which is not yet finished for visitors.
Tim saw sunlight glinting off aluminum struts in the distance. And directly below is our Mesozoic jungle river, where, if you are lucky, you just may catch a glimpse of a very rare carnivore. Keep your eyes peeled, everyone. Inside the Land Cruiser, the screen showed a bird-like head topped with a flaming red crest. But everyone in Tim's car was looking out the windows.